Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are entering what might be the most influential, but also maybe the most misunderstood text in Western history.
That's a good way to put it.
We are tackling the Old Testament, but not as a religious relic. Our guide today is Michael D. Coogan's really essential academic introduction, the Old Testament, a very short introduction.
And our mission here is to, you know, completely transform the way you read this text.
Yeah.
We're trying to move past that superficial familiarity that most of us have, you know, the Sunday school stories or famous quotes.
Yeah, the things you think you know.
Exactly. And dive into what the professional scholarly consensus actually is. We want to show you the tension between the book you think you know and, well, the library scholars understand.
That tension is the whole thing, isn't it? Because being truly well-informed about this text means recognizing that it's not just one single monolithic volume.
Not at all.
It's the foundational record of our legal, our ethical, our cultural DNA. And Coogan gives us this amazing shortcut to engaging with it intellectually, grounding our knowledge in history, not just tradition.
To do that, you really need a serious guide. And Michael D. Coogan is, well, he's Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at Stonehill College. And he's lectured on this at Harvard Divinity School.
Right.
When we talk about authority in this field, he's right at the very top.
And for you, the learner, I think the credential to remember is that he's the editor of the New Oxford Annotated Bible.
Which is huge.
Yeah. That role requires a complete mastery of this historical critical method. You have to be able to synthesize centuries of scholarship into notes that people can actually use.
And what really sets his work apart is his talent for accessibility. I mean, he takes concepts that usually live behind these, you know, impenetrable academic walls.
Like source criticism or comparative mythology.
Exactly. And he opens them up for a general audience. His tone is absolutely key. He stays strictly objective, treating the Bible like an ancient artifact, and he avoids both religious advocacy and, you know, cynical dismissal.
He's a historian and a literary critic first. So he isn't asking, what does this text require me to believe today?
No.
He's asking the much more fascinating question, what did this text mean to the people who wrote it, compiled it, and edited it 2,000 or 3,000 years ago?
And that question leads us straight to the book's central premise, which for many readers is immediately revolutionary. The Old Testament is not a single, divinely dictated, historically infallible document.
Okay, so here's the core truth that Coogan brings to light. It is a vast, complex, diverse anthology, a library that was written, compiled, edited, and re-edited by different authors, scribes, and religious schools over almost 1,000 years.
1,000 years. We're talking about texts that span from maybe the 10th century BCE all the way up to the 2nd century BCE.
Oh.
This is why he champions what's called the historical critical method. It's the scholarly toolkit for treating the Bible as a human product that is, you know, deeply tied to the history, the culture, and the power politics of the ancient Near East.
So if you read the Bible with 21st century literalism, you're just missing the point.
You miss the profound literary and historical depth of what the original authors were trying to do.
But that raises a really important question for people who hold this text as sacred. If we find human fingerprints everywhere, contradictions, edits, political influences, doesn't that automatically diminish its spiritual value?
You'd think so, but Coogan argues the exact opposite. The core insight is that recognizing the Old Testament's human origins and its long historical development actually illuminates its value.
How so?
It shows us a faith that was dynamic, that was adapting and reflecting over time. It makes the story richer, not poorer, because you're seeing a record of a people's active, ongoing conversation with God and with their own history.
Okay, so let's start digging into the text itself. First, we have to talk about the terminology, because even the name of the book is complicated.
Right. We have to distinguish between the Christian term, Old Testament, which obviously implies a new one followed, and the Jewish term, Hebrew Bible, or Tanakh.
They're the same basic texts, but the framing changes everything.
It changes the meaning entirely, depending on the tradition.
And for the curious learner, the shape of the book itself is, well, it's fluid. We tend to think of the Bible as this single fixed object.
Right, like it just dropped from the sky fully formed.
Exactly. But different religious traditions formalize different lists of books or canons. For instance, the Catholic and Orthodox traditions include what's called the Apocrypha or Deuterocanonical books.
Like Tobit and 1 and 2 Maccabees.
Or Protestants and Jews decided to exclude.
And that single fact, the inclusion or exclusion of certain books. It just shows that the shape of scripture is fundamentally the result of human, historical, and community decisions.
The text wasn't delivered to humanity bound and indexed.
It was assembled. And that assembly happened in the hotbed of the ancient Near East.
Which means you can't understand the Bible in a vacuum. Ancient Israel was just this small land bridge caught between superpowers.
Egypt on one side.
And the empires of Mesopotamia, Syria, and Babylonia on the other. Their culture, politics, literature. It was constantly in dialogue with these powerful neighbors.
And this is where the comparative mythology just becomes absolutely striking. Coogan points out that the biblical flood narrative in Genesis 6 to 9 is not a unique story.
Right. I think a lot of people are surprised by that.
They are. It has a clear and undeniable relationship to the much, much older Mesopotamian epic, the Epic of Gilgamesh.
And the creation story in Genesis 1.
Same thing. It parallels the Babylonian creation epic, the Enuma Elish. So the biblical authors were not creating in a vacuum at all. They were absorbing the raw materials of the cultures all around them.
But here's the key scholarly insight, right? They didn't just copy and paste.
No, not at all. They actively and creatively adapted these common myths to develop their unique theology. In the Mesopotamian myths, creation and flood are the result of these warring, chaotic, kind of capricious gods.
A whole pantheon of them.
Yeah. And the biblical authors took that structure, stripped away the chaos, stripped away the polytheism, and established a single, moral, purposeful God, Yahweh, who creates through his word and acts with justice.
That dynamic of borrowing and then purposefully adapting is central to, I think, the most famous concept in biblical scholarship, the documentary hypothesis.
Absolutely. This addresses who wrote the Torah, the first five books, which traditionally were all ascribed to Moses.
The documentary hypothesis, though, it posits that the Torah is really a masterwork of editing, woven together from at least four distinct source documents.
And this explains so much. It explains the internal doublets, why we have two separate creation accounts, two different versions of the flood, even contradictory laws.
So to visualize it, think of it less like one author and more like four different directors shooting the same story over, what, 500 years?
That's a great analogy. And we can even identify their signatures. You have J, the Yahwist, the earliest source, whose God is very personal and anthropomorphic, you know, walking and talking like a human.
Okay. And then?
Then there's E, the Elohist, whose God communicates more abstractly through dreams or messengers. You also have D, the Deuteronomist, which focuses heavily on conditional loyalty, the covenant, and centralizing worship in Jerusalem. That's mostly the book of Deuteronomy.
And last one is P.
The priestly source. This one is all about formal structure, ritual, law, genealogy, order. It's the source responsible for that clean 7-day creation framework we find in Genesis 1.
Understanding that four different worldviews contributed to the text, it just fundamentally changes how you process every single inconsistency.
It does. So if the Torah shows us how they compiled history, what about the prophetic literature? What does that tell us about their political and social battles?
The public often sees the prophets, like Isaiah, Amos, Jeremiah, as basically fortune tellers.
Right. But Coogan challenges that heavily.
He argues that biblical prophets were not primarily focused on predicting the distant future. They were fiery, immediate social critics, and theological interpreters of their own crises.
Yep. So less Nostradamus, more activist commentator.
Exactly. Their central concern wasn't about, say, ritual error. It was social injustice. They absolutely railed against the oppression of the poor, the manipulation of the legal system, and exploiting widows, orphans, and foreigners.
So when the Assyrians or Babylonians invaded, the prophets interpreted those invasions not as random luck, but as divine punishment for the nation's failure to uphold its ethical covenant.
That emphasis ethics over ritual is just immense. Now let's pivot to the proof dilemma, where history and faith kind of collide. People are always asking if archaeology proves the Bible.
And Coogan offers a really nuanced, responsible answer. Archaeology provides crucial context. It illuminates the world where these stories happen, but it can't definitively prove or disprove the divine claims of the text.
And sometimes that context directly challenges the traditional reading, which is important for any intellectually honest reader to grapple with.
Right. And the most challenging case study for this is the conquest of Canaan described in the book of Joshua. The biblical text presents a swift, coordinated military campaign resulting in total destruction.
But the archaeology tells a different story.
A vastly different and more complex picture. Many of the key cities Joshua supposedly destroyed show no signs of destruction during that period at all. The scholarly consensus suggests the emergence of Israel was a much more gradual, internal, and complex process.
So not a total foreign invasion?
Probably not. More likely, local population groups settling the highlands over a long period.
So the conclusion Coogan draws from this is vital. Biblical narratives are best understood as theological history.
Exactly. They were written not to provide the objective, factual record a modern historian would demand, but to convey a message about God's purpose, God's promise, and Israel's identity. The message is the truth, even if the historical method is different from ours.
This understanding of dynamic creation, it leads us to these three core themes that Coogan argues just fundamentally reshape our understanding. The first is the evolution of the idea of God itself.
This is probably the most surprising detail for many readers. Early Israelite religion suggested henotheism.
Which means?
It's the belief that while Yahweh was the supreme God they worshipped, they acknowledged that other nations had their own legitimate gods.
So like, our God is the best God, but your God is real too.
Exactly. Think of early Israel as a small nation focused on its own king, while acknowledging that other powerful kings exist.
And this changed over time.
It gradually evolved, especially after the trauma of the Babylonian exile, into radical, strict monotheism.
Yeah.
The belief that Yahweh is the only God in existence, period.
Understanding that theological evolution shows the text is a record of centuries of intense religious and philosophical reflection. It wasn't just a static doctrine.
Right. The second key takeaway is the nature of the covenant, or Berit. This wasn't some casual spiritual agreement. It was a rigorous legal framework.
Very formal.
Precisely. The covenant relationship between God and Israel is modeled directly on ancient Near Eastern suzerain vassal treaties.
Okay, break that down.
Think of it like a formal binding contract between a superpower, the suzerain, who is God, and a dependent state, the vassal, which is Israel. Loyalty is conditional. It depends on following specific non-negotiable laws.
That helps explain why the law, the Torah, is so intensely critical to the whole thing. It's the legal basis for the relationship.
It is. And this ancient legal structure gives us insight into how communities formalize binding responsibilities and legal codes even today.
And the third, and maybe the most enduring message, is the priority of ethical action, which ties right back to the prophets.
It does. The ethical legacy of the Old Testament is this non-negotiable demand for justice. The prophets taught that true faithfulness is inseparable from caring for the poor, the marginalized, and the vulnerable.
So you can't just separate your ritual observance from how you treat your neighbor.
They're two sides of the same coin. This is why the Old Testament remains a core resource for so many social justice movements today, and why its influence extends so far beyond religion into our philosophy and politics.
To really drive these points home, Coogan has some memorable statements that distill the book's core arguments. We picked out three that really sum up this scholarly shift.
Okay, here's the first one. The Old Testament is not a single work, but an anthology. To read it as one internally consistent book is to fundamentally misread it.
I love that. It basically gives the reader permission to embrace the complexity.
It does. It tells us we should read the creation myths as myth, the laws as law, and the poetry as poetry. It respects the literary diversity inside the collection.
Okay, second, and this one addresses the literalism debate.
Right.
The question is not whether the Bible is true, but what kind of truth it seeks to convey. The creation stories are profound theological reflections, not science.
That one is so freeing. It just removes the reader entirely from that artificial conflict between faith and science. The text is working in a theological genre.
Right. It's seeking existential truth. Why are we here? What's our purpose? Not empirical data about the age of the earth.
And finally, a statement summarizing his balanced approach to history. Archaeological evidence has both confirmed and challenged traditional interpretations of biblical history.
That line defines his intellectual honesty. Archaeology is a tool for context. It's not some simple machine for proving everything happened exactly as it's narrated.
It forces us into a much more nuanced, more mature engagement with the past.
So for you, the learner, what does taking this kind of rigorous historical approach actually do for you in the real world? I mean, beyond just mastering a difficult text, what transferable skills do you gain?
I think the biggest payoff is that the historical critical method is just intense training in enhanced critical thinking and media literacy.
How so?
Well, when you learn to identify the J, E, D, and P sources, asking who wrote this, when, and for what purpose, you are infinitely better equipped to spot bias, identify ghostwriters, or trace the source material behind a modern news article or a political speech or even a documentary.
It's like learning the anatomy of how narratives get built. If you can see the competing editorial agendas in Genesis, you can definitely see the competing interests in a modern corporate press release.
Absolutely. And in terms of dialogue, understanding the text's diverse origins, it fosters this immense intellectual humility and tolerance.
I can see that.
When you realize there are legitimate historical reasons why Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant traditions have different versions of the canon or different emphasis on law versus prophecy, it makes interfaith discussions so much more productive. You're arguing from context, not just contradiction.
And for readers of faith, this approach actually seems to create a deeper, more resilient faith.
It does. It roots belief in the historical complexity of human struggle and reflection, rather than a fragile literalist foundation that could be shattered by the next archaeological dig. The text becomes richer because it's a record of real, complicated human experience.
So what was the one takeaway that resonated most deeply with you?
For me, it was the realization that the prophets were essentially the original social justice warriors, that they saw economic exploitation as the central sin. It just completely shifts the focus from fire and brimstone to ethical responsibility right here and now.
Yeah.
The lesson that context is paramount for engaging with any ancient text is something you can just apply immediately to anything you read.
Coogan provides such a masterful bridge. He demystifies the Old Testament without ever diminishing its monumental power. The text emerges not as a dictation, but as this dynamic, multivocal library assembled across a millennium by ancient Israel's greatest thinkers who were grappling with the biggest questions of existence. I think the greatest reward is reading it now with the same intellectual honesty and rigor that they brought to its original creation.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.